1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 262, Surrender or Creative Adjustment, Mormon Responses to Mormonism, 1890-1918, by John A. Sillitoe and John S. McCormick.
The tape does start on time. Welcome. Just for your information, this is panel 262. The concurrent sessions from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. Paper, Surrender or Creative Adjustment, Mormon Responses to Modernism, 1890 to 1918. I'd like to take this opportunity to perfunctorily remind you that admission to this session, to all sessions, is by name tag or ticket only, and that if you are a crasher, go buy a ticket. Next, I'd like to introduce the two presenters. The first is John Sillitoe. He's an archivist and associate professor, libraries, at Weber State University. He's also the editor of a fine volume, might I add, of The Wilderness of Faith, Essays in Contemporary Mormon Thought. And then the other paper presenter is John S. McCormick. He's an assistant professor of history at Salt Lake Community College, and is a co-author of Salt Air. They will be largely discussing this book, The Latter-day Saints, A Study of the Mormons in the Light of Economic Conditions, originally by Ruth Kaufman and Reginald Wright Kaufman. This will, as a plug, be available before purchase at Benchmark Books. It's by University of Illinois Press. So without further ado, much ado, by the way, there will be a time at the end, I am told, for questions, should you have any. With that, I will turn it over to John Sillitoe. Thank you. My mistake. It will be to John McCormick.
Well, it is true that John Sillitoe and I often are confused. We've been referred to as the two Johns, and sometimes it's hard to make distinctions between us. Since we've been collaborating for a number of years on a variety of historical studies, mostly history of political radicalism, specifically the history of Socialist Party in Utah. And whenever we do do a joint presentation or author a paper that's to be presented, the question is, how should we handle that? John claims to have seen instances where people have alternated reading, stood side by side in front of a microphone, alternating reading either pages or paragraphs or, I don't know, parts of the paper. We thought about something like that and concluded that the best thing to do is probably alternate presentations at various conferences. So this is my turn to give our paper, but the point is this is very much a joint paper that we collaborated deeply on. It's the product of our collaboration. As I say, it's the product of a long-term collaboration for which I'm very grateful and have profited from a lot. Well, with that, by way of introduction, let me then begin the paper, which we've entitled Surrender or Creative Adjustment, Mormon Responses to Modernism, 1890-1918. And as was said, what we would like this to be is the beginning of a dialogue, a conversation, a discussion about that period of time, and so we'd be particularly interested in questions and comments, both formally and informally, at the conclusion of the presentation. The period from the late 19th into the early 20th century is an extremely important and fascinating period in Mormon history. To be more precise, the period from 1890, the year of the manifesto, to 1918, which marked the end of Joseph F. Smith's presidency. is an important and fascinating period. It's a period that a lot of historians have addressed and made important contributions to, historians like Leonard Arrington and Davis Bitton and Thomas Alexander and Leo Lyman and Robert Gottlieb and Peter Wiley. It's a period when the Mormon Church itself underwent a number of important changes, and when the relationship between the Mormon Church and the larger society changed in important and fundamental ways. For example, Robert Gottlieb and Peter Wiley in their 1984 study, America's Saints, refer to the period as, quote, the Great Accommodation, a period when, quote, Mormonism's most distinctive features gradually faded into the past and became the stuff of history. Henceforth, the saints would identify more and more with the America of Main Street and the Model T, unquote, and less with their own past. In their book, The Mormon Experience, Leonard Arrington and Davis Bitton, while acknowledging the force of that way of characterizing the period as an accommodation, also believe that the, quote, that Mormonism, quote, did not undergo a total melting into the national patterns. It was more a period of creative adjustment than accommodation, and accommodation is an inadequate overall interpretation of early 20th century Mormonism. Well, regardless of what label applies, and without going into the ins and outs of that, two questions I think arise. One is, first of all, what was going on during that period of time, and how ought that period to be characterized? And the second question is, who cares? Or more precisely, why should anyone care? Why should anyone other than the true believer or the narrow specialist care about that period of Mormon history or any other period? Or Mormon history in general. Perhaps the first serious attempt to answer both those questions came very early on and was offered by a pair of important American writers and journalists, Ruth and Reginald Wright Kaufman, who in 1912 published an important study they entitled The Latter-day Saints, quote, The Latter-day Saints, I'm sorry, A Study of the Mormons in the Light of Economic Conditions. It was published during a period of intense anti-Mormon activity both in the United States and in England. It was published during the muckraking period of American journalism. It drew a lot of attention. And it is an important contribution to our understanding of this period of Mormon history. It's little known today. John and I have argued that it ought to be better known. Our feeling is, in fact, that anyone seeking to understand this crucial period in Mormon history needs to come to grips with the kind of arguments that the Kaufmans lay out. In an effort to make their point of view better known, we recently wrote an introduction to a reprint edition of their book, The Latter-day Saints, which the University of Illinois Press published last year. What we would like to do in this paper is provide an overview of the arguments that the Kaufmans make in their 1912 book, The Latter-day Saints, what they have to say about Mormonism during that period of time and its coming to terms with modern America. The first point is this, that Ruth and Reginald Wright Kaufman brought a particular outlook to the task of examining Mormons and the Mormon Church. They were Marxists. They were Marxists who took it as a given that economic forces were primary in society and that capitalism was an unethical system of compulsion and domination. In their view, the history of Mormonism revealed all too well the nature and operation of capitalism, and for that reason was an important object of study. The Latter-day Saints, their book, dealt with a variety of subjects, including the origin and founding of Mormonism, the theory and practice of polygamy, the church's political activities, various aspects of Mormon history, in particular the Utah War and the Mountain Meadows Massacre. It was written within the tradition of the Mormon exposé. Much of it was simply repeated old charges that were sensational and exaggerated. For example, the extent of Mormon political influence beyond Utah. But the book also had much to say that was both new and insightful. And as I said, important for anyone seeking to understand the period to know. Their voice was unique. They realized, as Jan Shipps observed in a discussion of Utah politics, that the Mormon Church in the early 20th century continued to dominate the political, the social, the economic life of its people, and that such a conclusion did not necessarily stem from faulty logic or deliberate exaggeration. The Kaufmans saw a number of similarities between conditions in Utah and those in the United States as a whole. They knew that the antagonism between the Mormon Church toward the Mormon Church in the late 19th century was not simply a case of the persecution of a defenseless minority by an overzealous federal government. And they knew that more than just polygamy was at issue in that antagonism between Mormons and their larger society. Their belief was that friction was caused in large part by differing economic, political, and social orders, and therefore was inevitable. In other words, a basic point the Kaufmans argued was that the Mormon Church and the larger society were incompatible in fundamental ways, and that incompatibility would inevitably and did inevitably produce serious antagonisms. Let me just give you a little background about the Kaufmans, a little personal background. Ruth Kaufman was born in New York City in 1886. She graduated from Bryn Mawr, worked as an investigative reporter examining working conditions for women as domestic workers and in department stores and insurance offices, married Reginald Wright Kaufman. They together began a career of investigative reporting together and of writing, focusing their attention first of all on prostitution, or what was often at the time called white slavery, both in the United States and in England. During World War I, she served as a war correspondent for the New York Tribune, one of the first female war correspondents in the United States. And during her career, continued to write extensively, publishing a number of novels, children's books, and works of nonfiction. She died in Maine in 1952. Her husband, Reginald Wright Kaufman, was born in Pennsylvania in 1877, graduated from Harvard, worked as a reporter and an editorial writer for a number of newspapers, became an associate editor of the Saturday Evening Post, worked for, was the managing editor of a magazine known as the Delineator, which was a New York Reform Monthly that investigated conditions such as, or subjects such as women's suffrage, conditions in the nation's ghettos, became managing editor of Hampton's Magazine, which was the leading muckraking magazine of the time, and then in about 1910 resigned from that magazine to devote himself full-time to writing. He and his wife lived much of the next decade or so in England and France. He was a prolific writer throughout his life, publishing scores of articles, dozens of books, and finished his career as the editor of a small-town newspaper in Maine before his death in 1959. Probably his most prolific period of publication was between 1910 and 1913, during which period of time he published six books in a three-year period, something in some ways makes me envious. The first was an exposition of socialist theory and history entitled What is Socialism?, which was intended as an introduction to that subject, laying out the basic hints, history, and principles of socialism, which was a matter of considerable interest and concern during the period of time. That period, the early 20th century, was the one time in the United States when socialism was a viable political movement in the country, which had a considerable impact in the United States as a whole and in Utah, something John and I have been interested in investigating. The book was widely praised and received considerable notice. The other five books that he published during that period of time were four novels and The Latter-day Saints, the examination of the Mormons that I want to spend most of our attention on. And all of those books were intended as extended studies in capitalism to supplement and explicate the concepts set forth in What is Socialism? And though the subject matter of those novels and the Book on the Mormons were diverse, they all carried the same basic message, which was this, that capitalism was not so much a jungle as a prison. And escape for most people and most institutions was virtually impossible. In the Kaufman's view, the rise of corporations and the trend towards monopoly was the dominant fact of life in the United States in the early 20th century. It was perhaps the most serious problem the American people faced. Wealth and power were increasingly concentrated in the hands of a few who, because they held such wealth and therefore power, dominated the country's industrial, financial, and political life. All institutions, they argued, were subservient to the interests of capital. Such a situation created class division, facilitated the ascendancy of the strong over the weak, promoted the interests of the wealthy and the powerful at the expense of the weak and the poor, and led to the exploitation of the working class, who were condemned to difficult, dehumanizing work and subsistence wages. Under such circumstances, the Kaufman argued in those novels and in the Latter-day Saints, it was impossible even to speak of freedom. That was demonstrated through a study of prostitution, which was the subject of his best and best-selling novel, which he entitled The House of Bondage. It was shown through studies of sexual behavior, of marriage, and of politics, which were the subject of his next three novels, The Sentence of Silence, Running Sands, and The Spider's Web, and it was clearly seen in the history of Mormonism. Perhaps a brief discussion of what he has to say in his novel, The House of Bondage, will help in understanding what he and his wife had to say in The Latter-day Saints. One critic has called The House of Bondage the novel of prostitution of the progressive era. It went through 16 printings in less than 2 years, was translated into half a dozen foreign languages. The New York Times commended it for, quote, attacking and exposing one of the crying evils of the day, while Emma Goldman, the preeminent anarchist of the time, praised it for what she saw as its straightforward and unsentimental explanation of the forces that drove women to prostitution. The plot of the book is simple. Dissatisfied with her harsh life in a small Pennsylvania town, the heroine of the novel, Mary Denby, goes to New York City with a young man who promises to marry her. Once there, however, she's forced by her lover, who is really a pimp, to become a prostitute in an elegant brothel run by a woman named Rose Laguerre. Although she eventually escapes from the brothel, Violet, as she is now known, is able to find only menial, low-paying work. Ultimately, she comes to realize that the department store, the factory, the tenement are as confining and oppressive as the brothel. Sinking lower and lower, she finally becomes a dirty, diseased streetwalker. The only effective gesture of defiance she is able to make is to deliberately infect with syphilis the man who originally forced her into prostitution. Finally, in desperation, she returns to her original madam, who refuses to take her back. Nothing is left for her but the street and eventually a pauper's grave. Now, in the House of Bondage, Kaufman did not criticize the prostitute herself. He did not portray prostitution as a sign of individual moral depravity. His emphasis was not on individual choice and responsibility, but rather on economic and social conditions. For Kaufman, the prostitute was a victim of circumstances, because prostitution was embedded in the oppressive wage slavery and corrupt practices of capitalist society. Prostitution, he argued, was the natural byproduct of an economic system whose essential features were low wages, long hours, poor working conditions, limited opportunities, particularly for women. A character in the novel, a German socialist named Hermann Hoffmann, who befriends Mary, makes the point, explaining to her, after a Marxian survey of the economic and political framework of prostitution, that there is only one solution to the problem. One way, and only one, he says. For a single time, badness makes poverty. For the single time, badness makes poverty. 99 times, poverty makes badness. Do away with poverty. Reorganize the whole of the industrial system, give every man and woman a chance to work, give every man and woman every penny they earn. So only you do away with poverty, so only you do away with unhappy and discontented homes and unhappy and discontented people. So only you do away with badness. Well, Kaufman's message in the book was that the real house of bondage was capitalism, and prostitution was simply one form of slavery under a capitalistic economic system. The last line of the book serves as his essential indictment of capitalism and as an epitaph for all victims of competitive society. When Mary Denby, diseased and worn out, returns to Rose Laguerre's house in a last effort to stay alive, Rose refuses to take her back, saying, "It wouldn't be good business. You see, the life's got you, Violet. You're all in." Following the publication of The House of Bondage and those other novels examining other aspects of American social and economic system, the Kaufmans turned their attention to Mormonism. It's not clear how they came to that topic. Perhaps their interest originated during Reginald's days at Hampton's Magazine, which devoted some attention to organized religion, as did the muckraking press in general. And while he was editor, Hampton's published an article entitled "The Mormon Church and the Sugar Trust" by his friend and colleague Judson Welliver. By that time, also, the muckraking press, which had at first emphasized political corruption and business malpractice and the connection between the two, had begun to explore a wider range of subjects, including organized religion. And the muckraking press had begun to charge that the nation's churches were too conservative and too often allied with other institutions corrupting the nation and its people. The Kaufmans may also have been acquainted with Murray Schick, who was a Utah journalist and socialist, worked for the Salt Lake Tribune, who published an article entitled "Mormons and Mammon" in a socialist journal, The Coming Nation, which had a national circulation. Whatever the origin of their interest, though, their intent was to use Mormonism as an aid to understanding the larger society of which it was a part. Just as in The House of Bondage, he had used prostitution as a lens to focus on and illuminate the economic inequalities of American life. The Latter-day Saints, then, their book, The Latter-day Saints, Mormons in the Light of Economic Conditions, is both a study of the Mormon Church and a portrayal of the society whose values and practices shaped it. So, something finally about what they have to say in the Latter-day Saints. From their Marxian socialist perspective, the Kaufmans believe there were two fundamental points to be made about the Mormon Church. The first was that it was a conservative, even a reactionary institution. The second and more significant point for them, that it was a victim entrapped in the operations of capitalist society. It was originally theocratic, polygamous, communitarian, they pointed out. It had once posed a challenge to America. It had offered a powerful critique of American society and culture. It once was, as Robert Flanders said in the 1960s, it once was a counterculture. But near the end of the 19th century, they pointed out, it changed. It came increasingly to conform to American values and practices, embracing what it had once opposed, and had begun a process of integration into American society. Specifically, it became capitalistic, and in the process came to support some of the worst aspects of American life. It became a big business allied with other big businesses in exploiting the American people as well as its own members. Now that is a powerful and a harsh critique. That is, they were not mincing words or pulling punches in saying that. For the Kaufmans, the Mormon Church was not primarily a spiritual organization, or at least it was important that it be understood as not just a spiritual organization. Unlike many critics of the time who saw Mormonism primarily as a religious problem, the Kaufmans were not much interested in Mormon theology. They dismissed Mormon theology as at best curious and as at worst absurd. Now, that project obviously has serious drawbacks. It clearly led them to underestimate the appeal of the Mormon Church's spiritual message. It meant there were many things about the Mormon Church they simply did not and perhaps could not understand. But that approach also served as a needed corrective to a narrow interpretation of Mormonism, and it resulted in a number of valuable insights. First and foremost, they said, Mormonism was a capitalistic institution. The Mormon hierarchy, they pointed out, was made up mainly of businessmen who held a business point of view. The church itself was a large business concern, owning and operating or having an interest in a variety of enterprises: street railroads, light and power plants, salt works, sugar factories, mercantile establishments, insurance companies, publishing houses, newspapers, theaters, resorts, farms, ranches. Though those facts were widely known, the Kaufmans said, their implications often went unappreciated. Since the interests of the Mormon Church were the same as those of other large businesses, they pointed out, the church acted no differently than did any other business. That is, it acted not only as a church, they said it also acted as a business, because as a business it was concerned with a bottom line, making a profit. Thus, for example, they said it opposed labor unions, it acted as a strike breaker, it sought to restrain competition by allying itself with monopolistic organizations in the country. In addition, the Kaufmans asserted, in the interest of making a profit, the Mormon Church often violated its own religious principles. For example, it was originally intended that the church-owned Salt Air Resort on the Great Salt Lake be closed on Sunday and that liquor not be sold there. However, it quickly became clear that neither the resort nor the church-owned railroad connecting the resort with Salt Lake City would make a profit under such circumstances, and so the church quickly allowed both the sale of liquor at Salt Air and operation of the resort on the Sabbath. At the same time, the church allowed liquor to be sold in the church-owned Hotel Utah for the same reason, profit, and when that decision provoked some outcry among church members, church president Joseph F. Smith felt compelled to explain his reasoning for that decision at General Conference in October of 1911. The Mormon Church, the Kaufman said, not only acted like a business, it also acted with other businesses, and in doing so actively supported the contemporary trend in the United States towards monopoly and the evils associated with the rise of corporate capitalism. That development was most clearly seen, the Kaufmans felt, in the church's relationship with the sugar and railroad industries. And they spent considerable time, and I think I won't lay out the details of their discussion, but they spent considerable time in their book discussing the relationship between the Mormon Church-owned beet sugar companies and Henry Havermeyer's American Sugar Refining Company, which by the early 20th century had a virtual monopoly on the sugar industry of the United States. They discussed also the connection between the Mormon Church the electric railroads which the Mormon Church owned and its connection to the railroad industry in the country as a whole, particularly that of Edward Harriman. The essential argument the Kaufmans were making was that by the end of the first decade of the 20th century, the Mormon Church had become an appendage of the capitalistic system, whereas it had once rejected capitalism, whereas it once had seriously called into question the essential features and basic ideas of capitalism. By the early 20th century, as they said, it had become an appendage of the capitalistic system. As part of that, it was not involved in efforts to limit corporate abuse of economic and political power. Rather than opposing the concentration of wealth, one of the most serious problems confronting early 20th century America, in their view, rather than denouncing the alliance between business and government, church activities often came to support those things. In important ways, the Kaufmans argued, the Mormon Church was subservient to the needs of capital, with a capital C. It provided one more example of, quote, the present wrong and the future impotence of churches and laws, of government, politics, and property. Now that, the Kaufmans said, was an important point to understand. That is, the alliance between the Mormon Church, the connection, the relationship between the Mormon Church and emerging corporate America. But even more important to understand, they said, was why the church acted as it did, how it came to be in the position it came to be in. And in their view, the church was in many ways a victim of economic forces. It acted out of necessity, not out of choice, in beginning a process of accommodation with America. It gave up much of what made it different and adopted the ways of the larger society as a matter of survival. The Kaufmans pointed out, in support of that, or in support of that, the Kaufmans went through sort of a standard review of the relationship of the increasingly difficult relationship of the Mormon Church with the larger society from the beginning. They pointed out that the church had encountered hostility almost from the moment of its founding. They pointed out that conflict with the American people and the federal government was a constant of Mormon history to the last decade of the 19th century. The cause of the conflict, though, they said, was not a moral one, as was widely as not the essential issue. Hatred of polygamy and polygamy itself had been at its height employed for economic reasons was not the origin of the attack upon Mormonism. The origin of that attack was economic, unquote. Mormon communitarianism, they said, not Mormon marriage customs, was under attack. In their view, religious and moral objections to Mormonism were mere smoke screens thrown up by disgruntled elements disturbed by Mormon solutions of their economic difficulties through cooperation, which dried up income for speculative interests. The expansion of capitalism through the elimination of Mormon economic enterprise, not the elimination of polygamy, they said, was the real effort and concern. The Kaufmans argued that initially the Mormons had created a self-sufficient, cooperative, egalitarian, authoritarian economy devoted to the collective well-being of the whole. Through a system of cooperative and compulsory labor, Mormons accomplished impressive feats of planning and development, Irrigation projects, roads, canals, beet sugar factories, iron works had been built without creating the inequities elsewhere associated with industrial progress. But, they said, the practices of the Mormons, the economic practices, interfered with the spread of capitalistic institutions, and beginning with the Mormon War of the late 1850s, when federal troops were sent here, the federal government harassed the Mormons through a combination of military, legislative, judicial actions, all of which were supported by large segments of public opinion. Pressure against the Mormons culminated in the 1880s with the passage of two pieces of legislation, the Edmunds Act and the Edmunds-Tucker Act, which were harsh but were constitutionally questionable, but clearly reflected the will of most Americans and had the bipartisan support of nearly all leaders of government. In the face of that kind of pressure, Mormons reluctantly gave up not only the practice of polygamy, but disbanded their people's political party and changed their economic practices, beginning overall a process of participation in and accommodation to the national economy. And when that happened, when they made those fundamental changes, pressure from the federal government and the American people gradually ceased. One of my... An important historian named Dale Morgan has characterized the history of Utah and the history of the Mormon Church as the transformation of the kingdom of God into another among the kingdoms of the world. Which I think is a nice way of characterizing in one sentence much of what happened. The Kaufmans anticipated that comment. They were arguing very much the same kind of thing, and they were seeking to understand and explain why that transformation had taken place. One of the strengths of their explanation is that they viewed the Mormon Church not as a static, but as an evolving, dynamic institution. They also felt it was necessary to see the Mormon Church not only as a spiritual organization, but as an economic and social one with concrete ties to other institutions in the country. And they also saw the necessity, in order to understand Mormonism, of moving beyond the simple statement of facts to the examination of the meaning of those facts in the light, as they said, of present conditions. The final point, I guess, is this. For the Kaufmans, what did the Mormon experience add up to? What did it all mean? Why did it matter? And for them, the point is this. The Mormon experience demonstrated the difficulty of being in the world but not of the world. But the source of that difficulty, they said, was not with Mormons themselves. It lay with external factors. It was not, in a lot of ways, they would have agreed with a later historian of Puritan New England, Perry Miller, who said the history of the Puritans was the history of the failure of a dream. Now, I've sometimes said the history of Utah and the Mormon Church is the history of the failure of a dream. And every time I say that, that is a dangerous kind of thing to say because that can so easily be misinterpreted. But the fact is, the Kaufmans pointed out, or the Kaufmans felt as if a large degree of failure in the Mormon enterprise needed to be recognized. And then their question is, what was the cause of the failure? And their answer was, it was not weakness in Mormons themselves that led to their failure. It was the nature of the larger society in which they sought to and, in fact, had to exist. Given the nature of that society, given its essential features, success was difficult, if not impossible. In other words, the Kaufmans, and I think this is certainly one of the strengths of their account, the Kaufmans recognized, in other words, a central fact According to historian Christopher Lash, it may be the most important fact of Mormon history, which is this: as long as Mormons were different, they would not be tolerated by an expanding capitalistic system. Only when they gave up their chief distinguishing features would antagonism toward them cease. In capitalistic society, Ruth and Reginald Kaufman believed, victims abounded. The Mormon Church was one such victim. Thank you. Now, having said that we would be very pleased to respond to questions and comments, I'm going to say, first of all, I hope there are some. And second of all, I'm going to let John now stand and begin to respond to some of those questions.
Are there questions or more significantly, even comments? Yeah, Bill. I don't know if I can repeat that question exactly. But I think the gist of it was this. Doesn't this book tell us more about the Kaufmans themselves as products of early 20th century American left than it does about the Mormons? Are its insights particularly apt in terms of Mormonism at all? I think that that's a fair question and a fair criticism of their work. I think it is, in fact, best understood in light of the context in which it was written. It was written at an intense point in anti-Mormon feeling. And frankly, the Kaufmans repeat much of that tabloid journalism of the times. It was also written, I think, at a high point of socialist activity in the United States, emphasizing a particular brand of socialism. And that socialism was an evolutionary, electoral-oriented, largely left-wing of the progressive movement kind of a socialism, of which Ruth and Reginald Kaufman and many other clergymen were certainly a part. I don't want to get into a huge discussion of Marxism, but simply I think it's important to suggest that I think that understanding that is very important because, in fact, I think the commitment of those people was not so much to Marxism, though they would call themselves Marxists, as it was to a kind of a left-wing liberalism. And in that sense, I think they were looking for people to blame more than they were looking for a particular kind of a Marxist solution to the problems of society. I think they looked at what was happening in Utah in terms of the sugar company or the railroad trust or whatever, and they saw the boogeyman and the villain, and they identified it as such. I think in some ways it helps us better understand that notion of what's happening in America than it does maybe particularly in terms of Mormonism. In fact, I think that's a real crucial period of time. A lot is happening in the United States in the period prior to World War I, and World War I will become an important demarcation point. Once the war starts, many of those people who prior to the war saw themselves as Marxists, who saw themselves as left-wingers, very quickly supported the war, certainly the Kaufmans did. And by the 1920s, the Kaufmans are voting the Republican ticket. A larger question is, how do you get from being a Marxist in 1912 to voting for Warren G. Harding in 1920? Well, maybe it's one answer is that the commitment of these folks to a socialist notion of society wasn't all that strong. Nonetheless, I think in their defense, they raise an early version of something that will be later really dealt with in a better way by Gottlieb and Wiley, particularly perhaps also by Heinemann and Shoup, and certainly by historians like Tom Alexander and others. How do you straddle that fence between being initially outside of the system and now very much a part of it? And their argument would be, of course they did the things they did, simply because they had no other alternative but to do them, and in fact they really believed in them. I think that's a real key point about that period of time. Smoot, the political machine of the Republican Party, the hierarchy, really believed that tying the church to the capitalist bandwagon, or more accurately, to the prevailing political structure in the country, was really the right thing to do. And in part, it resulted, I think, because for better than a decade, beginning with the Edmunds Act and particularly the Edmunds-Tucker Act in the late 1880s, the church had been getting really kicked around. The irony of all this is that while Kaufman and the Kaufmans would criticize the church for moving away from their communal roots to accepting capitalism or whatever, in some ways the critics of the church that are fundamentalists would argue a similar kind of an argument. They're both arguing, hey, you're moving away from your roots to an accommodation with secular society, and that's wrong. I don't know if that really answers your question, but I think I think your questions, your series of statements really do raise some important points that we need to think about in terms of our ongoing understanding of not just this book and these individuals, but exactly what is happening in that early period of time. One last thought on that. The socialists in Utah find themselves in a very difficult position. They realize that they cannot exist if they too strongly criticize the Mormon Church. And many of the members of the Socialist Party will downplay that criticism and point to the fact that large numbers of socialists in Utah are in fact active and believing Mormons, and they would argue that their commitment to socialism comes from that same communal United Order heritage. We first started doing our research on Utah socialism and found names like, you know, Parley Pratt Washburn and Wilfred Woodruff Freckleton and Joseph Smith Jessup. We assumed that these socialists were not, you know, Congregationalists or Unitarians. It's pretty clear what their religious orientation was. So it's a real difficult period of time. It's an important period of time. It's one that's been studied, that continues to be studied, and I think there's a lot in understanding contemporary Mormonism in understanding that period. Did you have
I just want to say something real quickly, just picking up. Well, which would be this. Clearly, the Kaufmans were not sophisticated Marxists in any sense. They were very simple and, in some ways, crude Marxists. And their analysis, in some ways, was a crude one. Even so, it seems to me that at a minimum, they asked some important questions. They didn't ask all the important questions, and they ignored some important ones. But some of the questions they asked were important ones. They were questions that were not much being asked then. They're important questions to ask. They need to be asked. And so, in some ways, I guess I would say, while theirs was a simplistic or crude analysis, it is still a valuable one. It's still a valuable one.
Okay. Other questions or comments? That was a pretty good answer, by the way. I wish I had that before.
I just have a comment. In the course of studying for a lesson explaining Official Declaration 1 when church history was taught a few years ago in Sunday school, I did an extensive amount of reading, and as a conservative Republican came to the conclusion that polygamy was merely a smokescreen and a club with which to beat the church, and that the real agenda was really the breakup of the communitarian and theocratic structure of the church. And it's kind of interesting that I actually came to that conclusion and find that people at the opposite end of the spectrum have similarly come at that conclusion.
Yeah. I'm going to let John answer the second part of that question. The first part of that question is it was well received. It was published, you have to understand, it was published in England under an English imprint, and therefore it never got the kind of distribution in the United States it would have had it been published in the United States as well. But it was reviewed in the New York papers. It got good reviews. It was suggested that these folks had written an important book and they were asking some important questions. Again, I think it was a product of the times. The fact that it was published in 1912, I think, and not 1906 or 1920 is indicative of the huge interest there was in Mormonism at that period of time, particularly in England where it was published. And I think that also accounts for the fact that much of the book deals with the same old tabloid kinds of charges on the church. Had it not been published at that time, they might not have felt so compelled to keep repeating some of the stories that have been repeated many, many times before. What do you think about that last part? I'm going to let you answer that.
Whether or not these are questions still worth asking, and are they, in fact, being pursued? And well, I think, first of all, those are important questions to keep asking. And I think they're not being pursued as much as they might be. I find a tendency sometimes among Mormon historians to draw back from asking certain questions or producing certain pursuing certain lines of inquiry, or when those questions are asked and those lines pursued, I find a kind of a drawing back and an attempt to put the best possible face on what might be an uncomfortable subject. Yeah. So I would say, again, important questions to pursue. I mean, the history of understanding the history of a communitarian movement, understanding what, as John says, a movement that moves from its communitarian roots to something else and why it does that, is a really important enterprise. That enterprise, I guess, maybe we're suggesting, began with the Kaufmans and continues and needs to continue, because we don't don't fully understand what went on, and sometimes we don't want to fully understand it.
That could be. One of the interesting similarities between this book and the work of Robert Gottlieb and Peter Wiley, I don't know if you know their book, but America's Saints, it called, and in the subtitle is Question of the Rise of Mormon Power. And when that book was published, a lot of people criticized it for the same reasons that we talked about with the Kaufmans. All you people want to talk about is power and power relationships and all that sort of thing. Well, that's what the book's all about. That's why that gave it the title it was. You folks don't want to talk about the spiritual aspects of Mormonism. Well, that's another story in another book. I think that that question of Mormon power and its ties to economic and political establishment, particularly in Utah but elsewhere, is an ongoing question. And how that all works, and I don't know that it's a conspiracy necessarily. I guess when everybody agrees that it's happening, it can't be too conspiratorial. I'd like to see somebody right now do a book about the Olympics. How does that happen? What is the coalition in this state that unites the AFL-CIO and the Mormon Church, among others, in support of bringing this Olympics to Utah? How does the church fit into power relationships, I think, is a more sophisticated question than perhaps the Kaufmans dealt with, and one that will continue. Have we got time for one more?
One more question.
Okay. Anybody else have a question or comment? Yeah. Uh-huh.
I think there's sort of a, that we would ever go back.
I don't personally either. I think if the court were to decide that polygamy was an okay practice, the biggest opponent of it would be the Mormon Church, which is the irony of all ironies. No, I don't see that going back. In fact, I think that I wish I could remember the quote. Hugh Nibley has a good quote. I don't know if you can remember that Nibley quote, where in essence he says, you know, communalism is one of those venerated principles of the past that everybody sort of appreciates, but nobody really wants to implement. We're moving on. I mean, how can a society that's as corporately oriented as our society, and Mormon society particularly, I can't imagine them going back to a more communalistic. Now, the counter-argument to that is to say, well, yeah, but you, again, have missed the spiritual. What you're talking about is simply an economic system. The United Order was, in fact, more than that, was, in fact, only an economic system that could succeed in the context of a commitment to spiritual values. Having said that, I still don't see our society rolling back to that kind of a society. Maybe others do. Well, appreciate your comments and questions. Look forward to your review, and turn time back to you.
I'd just like to ask for a round of applause for some fine presentations there. And while I have just a brief moment, I want to remind you that this will be on audio cassette and will be available. I was one that did not consider buying this volume. After having the presentation, I am going to go out and buy it. It sounds like an excellent book, and I hope you all give it a chance. Thank you for coming.
What am I looking for? Thanks.
You know, it's...